Hey, welcome to Collaboracast. I'm your host, Ben Leroy, and with me, as always, my dear friend and wonderful human being, Jason Buchholz. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ben. How are you doing?
Doing all right. What's on tap for today?
Today, we've got all kinds of listener questions,
awesome,
which we'll mash up with some FAQs as they come through our brains, and let's jump into them.
All right, sounds good. How do people know whether or not they should be hiring a professional editor? It has been my experience that roughly you can divide people into two camps, and that one of those camps has got multiple earlier books hanging around in desk drawers because they've spent the time of like writing books, learning what they can learn, and then realizing that that book is not ready to be published and that the amount of work that would go into fixing it doesn't feel worth it to them, so they start a new project. Then I've also met authors who this is the first novel that they've written. They haven't had any real experience. They haven't had a writer's group. They haven't done an MFA program. They haven't taken a creative writing class. So they're just really trying to do their best approximation of what they've read and what they think works for them. That's good, but there's no long-term ability to assess and process. And those folks, I feel, are probably more inclined to want to get a professional's perspective.
Yeah, it sounds like those would be good candidates for that perspective and for some expertise.
There's backlash, and rightfully so, against the idea that everybody needs an editor. And then because there are so many choices, and because it's an unregulated field, thinking all editors are the same. I'm going to hire an editor because I need a book edited. But that's wildly incorrect as far as skill set and ability to be a meaningful editor for a book. And because that situation and that system exists, the default reactive advice in many corners is don't hire an editor.
It's another common question is how do I hire an editor? How do I know who is a good editor?
Yeah. And that one, you would look to see what is the person's background? Have they worked in traditional publishing? Have books that they were responsible for editing made it to notable bestseller lists? And for the purpose of this discussion, I'm very specifically saying notable bestseller lists because things like Amazon bestseller lists, which often get used as a mark of credibility, are either easily manipulated or so micro-specific that it's meaningless. Looking at, when evaluating an editor, looking at who their clients are and what sort of success, both critically and commercially, books have received is a great indicator. Also, it's important to assess what is it that you're really hiring an editor for, because it could be to fix up one specific book and manuscript, but it could also be to help fill in the gaps of knowledge where a writer has not had specific training and experience and conversation regarding the process and style and craft.
That's been my own experience. As I've talked about before, I've hired a writing coach to help me with a nonfiction project. Obviously, as you well know, I'm a published fiction author, but I've worked in some other genres early in my career, like some travel writing and journalism. but came to a point in my life where I wanted to write a book length nonfiction manuscript and didn't really know how to go about doing it. Even though I've been working in writing and have an MFA, but yeah, like you said, it was a combination of factors that I wanted to get some help with and get some, and it's been really beneficial.
One of the things that I often see people talking about as an argument against hiring an editor is that they're expensive, and that can certainly be the case. And people should definitely figure out if the money invested is worth it, if there's a return on investment. And for me personally, I like to stress that we're working on a book, but really what I'm hoping to do is give advice and teaching that works, not just for the book in question, but future work and just understanding of craft. And that's
right.
How I approach it.
Teaching so someone how to fish versus giving them fish, I think is very much the editorial.
Right.
A good editorial relationship.
And in addition to the idea of, is this financially viable? One of the pushbacks that I've seen of late, and I'm going to push back on the pushback, is that you shouldn't hire an editor because if you do hire an editor and your book gets into shape enough that an agent seeks to represent you, or even better, a larger publisher asks to acquire your work, that somehow you're being deceitful in presenting this book because you worked with an editor. And that, so the argument goes, an agent and a publisher will be disappointed to find out that you didn't write this book entirely on your own merits and that you had outside help in the form of an editor. And I see this getting repeated often in online writers groups. And I have to say that from my own experience, both talking with agents, but also as somebody who does acquisitions, who is reading through acquisition emails from agents and from unagented authors, this is not a concern that I ever had in my life as far as it being considered cheating or deceptive for a writer to hire an editor.
Right. You're just looking for the best quality manuscript you can find.
Precisely.
It would be like, I think that argument is analogous to going to a restaurant and saying, well, I don't want the dish if the chef really learned how to cook well. I only want to eat whatever is innate cooking. It's like, no, you want to have a good meal. You don't really care how the chef came to be able to make it.
Presumably, if you worked with an editor to get your book into the kind of shape that an agent would be interested in, that a larger publisher would acquire it, presumably you'll be able to do that again, either with that same editor or with a different editor. You can't take raw slop and have it run through an editing process and machine and have it come out the other side as ready to go book. That's just not going to happen. There has to be a baseline there. And clearly, just even through working the process, the book has been made better.
I think it also demonstrates a commitment to the craft and to professional development. Is that something, have you noted from an acquiring editor standpoint, is that something that matters to you that you've looked for?
No. And I actually see sometimes that people will mention in their query letters that they worked with a particular freelance editor. I think the goal there is to suggest some sort of legitimacy. Often I don't know who the editor is. And that's not because they're a bad editor or a good editor. It just means that I don't go out and seek out to know what's going on in the freelance editorial world. I don't know who's out there doing what. But it's information I don't need and I just don't really care about, and it doesn't affect my decision one way or the other. In summary, what I would say is that I believe the right editor, the right reviewer of words, can provide a valuable service that is worth paying for. That said, financial realities are financial realities. And if it's the money isn't there to do something like that, what I don't want is people to think if I just spend X amount of dollars on getting an editor, that's going to lead to me getting a book deal and I'm going to make $1 million and this will all pay for itself. That's magical thinking and not grounded in reality. So there are arguments for hiring an editor, and then there are legitimate arguments for where it's not worth it. The return on investment is not there, and that's going to be an individual choice for everybody. But some of the reasons why people say don't do it, I don't think are universal.
I think the return on investment is an interesting aspect. I think that some people go into this thinking of it as a financial investment, and it's not. I mean, I think that the return needs to be your sense of satisfaction at having the best manuscript that you can produce, at having gone through that process or the process of an MFA or whatever it is, in order to attain a level of fluency or mastery with the craft. And that's what you're investing in. It's more of a, you know, it's not, well, if I put $5,000 into professional editing, I want to make sure that I'm able to get my money back on book sales. I don't think many financial advisors out there are recommending to people that they go get creative writing MFAs, because that's going to pay off in the long run. So yeah, that return needs to be something that is something other than dollars.
One of the other questions that came into us, and maybe this is a perfect segue or additional part of the conversation, is I've been answering that question as though a writer was intending to be traditionally published, where they're going through an agent and they're landing with a larger publisher, and the larger publisher will have an in-house editor that will also be working with them. It's, you can assume that if the house acquired it, they already are relatively happy with the editorial direction of the piece, because they're not going to spend years and years trying to help get a book into superhuman shape.
Yeah. They don't buy fixer uppers.
Yeah, but this question of, do I need an editor if you're planning on self-publishing? That's a different conversation, because now you don't actually have the benefit, whatever benefit it offers in 21st century world. You don't have the benefit of an in-house editor working on it. And you do need to quality control your book, because when it gets out into the marketplace, it will not be graded on a curve. No one is going to say, well, this is a great self-published book, but it's mediocre when compared to traditional publishing. That's not going to be a discussion. Right. It's either going to be this book is good or this book is not. And I'm obviously oversimplifying it, but
you don't get a pass for typos because you're self-publishing.
So I can see an argument that if you're going to self-publish, then it's worth digging into this idea of, why am I hiring an editor, and what can an editor do as far as making sure that my book is at market standards? And that, again, is going to be dependent entirely on the editor. What is their resume? What is their background? And I know personally that I've been editing books for 20 plus years, and most of that time was spent doing it for a traditional publishing company. And now I do editing on a freelance basis and hear what we're doing at Collaborist. But a few years ago, I realized that my skill set is limited in certain areas where a client definitely needs to have somebody have the full complement of skills. And the way that I got around that deficiency on my side was that Sarah Henry and I started working together because Sarah's brain and my brain operate in two different ways, and we're able to provide full coverage when we're doing and editing things. Sarah's picking up on things that I would miss, and I'm picking up on things that Sarah would miss. That's part of when you and I and Sarah and some other people were talking about how Collaborist would be operating and what it would be doing differently. The idea of taking that team approach and being able to have a bunch of professionals on hand, hearing what a project is about, and then saying, okay, these are the people that you would want working on this book to make sure that it gets everything that it's going to need.
Community approach. Another question I hear a lot is, how long should my book be? Or I'll have people who call and they'll say, you know, I'm about so far, I'm, you know, 30,000 words, but, you know, I really have no idea what I should be shooting for. So what I tell them is that it varies based on genre and based on who you are. Not a lot of people can just write The Infinite Jest as a first time novel and throw it out there. So, first time novelist, what would you say? Kind of 90K plus or minus?
I think that that's all going to be dependent on what genre they're working in. And I think 90,000 is a good word if you're working for mainstream commercial fiction. But I know that if you're doing fantasy, for instance, where there's going to be some world building, the length is going to be longer. If you're working on middle grade or YA, the word count might be a little bit shorter. So it's really what is the market already established as norms? And it's pretty easy to find the books that you think belong on the same shelf as yours and the ones that you're kind of judging yourself against or imagining yourself being a part of, and figuring out what does that word count look like? What sort of average, what sort of number can you pull from that?
Yeah, and a little shorter for nonfiction. I find most mainstream nonfiction is more like in the 50 to 70,000 word range. I think you bring up an interesting point, though. I think a lot of authors don't have clarity around the differences between MG, which are middle grade books, and YA, which are young adult. You want to do your research if you're aiming a book at those age ranges, the age of your protagonist, the sorts of challenges, the sorts of themes are going to vary if you're writing a book that's for 10-year-olds versus 13-year-olds versus 16-year-olds, and they can vary pretty widely. So every now and then I'll find someone who says, oh, you know, it's for anybody who's like kind of between 10 and 18. I'm like, no, an 18-year-old doesn't want to read the same book that a 10-year-old wants to read.
Right.
So fine. Yeah. It's between, if you're between 40 and 48, then fine. That's you could have that 8-year age range and you'd be pretty confident that you're sweeping up everybody in that category. But when it comes to middle grade and young adult, they're looking for very different things and, different themes, different ages of protagonists. Typically people like to read about protagonists who are a couple of years older than them and dealing with the sorts of challenges and themes that are kind of right on the horizon for that readership.
Yeah, I have definitely had to encourage people who are working on projects to think more about those kinds of things, because it's easy to say, like you pointed out, yeah, anyone 10 to 18. Well, no. And then I'll also have people who have clearly found some sort of questionnaire or self-assessment thing online that asks like, who is your market? Who is your target reader? And then people will be so general about it because in their head, they want to think that they're going to have readers that fall across that spectrum. It'll be like men and women ages 18 to 70 who are interested in American life. Okay, well, that's...
My favorite is there are X number of English speakers in the world. It's like, okay, that, you know, technically, you know, some of these things feel kind of formulaic almost. You know, I think that there are, we get into this realm where there are, where people say, well, like I'm an artist. Why do I need to follow these conventions? Why does this need to be X, Y, and Z? Why does this need to be cookie cutter? Why do I need to follow these templates? And to some degree, you know, I can understand that, and I'm all for people who are trying to explore the boundaries of those things. But at least in terms of traditional publishing, there are industry realities, and you're asking somebody to put up a lot of money on your behalf to get this book into the world. And risk-taking comes at a high cost for them. And so the more experimental you are, the less likely you are to get a traditional publishing deal. If you want to self-publish, then go for it. You know, break all the rules and do whatever you want. But then you've also, you kind of have the same problem on the back end as of that when you go to try to market it, when you try to figure out who to sell your book to.
This is another place where having a professional do an edit or a manuscript evaluation can be helpful because they're going to ask questions about who is your target market. And if you give them that information, and as they're reading it, they say, this isn't going to appeal to a large section of who you identified. They basically can ask the hard questions to have the conversation with an author to help them better understand what it is they're doing. And I often talk about that I'd like to know what a writer's intention was before beginning the book and what they think they've written when they're at the end of their book, and I want to know what they think they've written. And then I read it and I compare what my read is to what I was told they wrote. And it's very common for people to set out on one journey, get to a different destination, but still remember what they set out for and think that that's what it is. Like I'm here at A and my intention is to get to G, and they start at A and they end up at K, and they're like, yep, so here I am at G, and I have to like pull out the map and be like, no, you took a turn here and now you're at K, which is fine. It's fine to be there, but you're not where you initially thought you were. So let's now examine, did you mean to go off track? Are you happy that you took a different route and ended up somewhere else? Do you want to address what's different about this and get your book to G where you initially set out? That's again part of that asking questions and understanding what it is you've written and where it fits in the bookshelf literary canon.
You had a point about hiring an editor who is specific to that genre. And that's just this morning I read a masterful developmental feedback letter on a YA novel by somebody who is very a editor I know who's well versed in that genre. And it was a masterclass in what in genre specificity. So she, the editor, was, you know, reviewing the author's novel and saying, okay, if you want this to really be successful in that genre, here are a list of themes that people look for. Here are the sorts of, here are some other ways that you can tweak this to really make this stand out per the conventions, per the market for that particular genre. And those sorts of things are that's where the research comes in. Or to a large degree, you can kind of write in isolation, but it only goes, I think you're leaving behind opportunities if you do that. I think that there's a lot to learn, not just about the craft of writing as in putting sentences together, but in terms of how to craft stories, how to select protagonists and the sorts of problems that they're facing, in learning what kind of appeal those will have to whom.
This is probably a good opportunity for us to mention that if you don't have access to being able to hire an editor, or you don't feel it's right for you, there are resources that can help that are much lower cost or free altogether. And one of those would be the writers groups that we're offering here at Collaborist. You can work with people who are specializing in different genres, who are published authors or publishing industry professionals. You can network with other authors while you're doing that, so you can get feedback. You can hear how different people are reading and processing your work, and you can get that kind of feedback. And those groups, at least on our website, collaborist.org, are free to join. There is a limited class size, just so to make sure that everyone gets the attention and help that they can get. But there are resources available, and that's one of the goals that we've got in place, is to make resources available where they might not otherwise be. Got another question here that says, are you able to listen to music while you write? And if so, which albums do you find are most helpful as part of your process?
I don't listen to music when I write anymore. I used to.
Was that a conscious decision, or it's just happened over time?
I think it just happened over time. I think life in general used to just be a lot noisier and cluttered through all the senses. And just as I get older, maybe I'm just getting worn out. I tend to think better when things quiet down. I've come to find. Also, I've changed I used to write late at night, and now I don't. I get up early and I write now. So it's just getting older.
Yeah, we're definitely no longer spring chickens. I actually listen, and I'm the exact opposite of you, because I'll have three or four audio things going at once. And part of that is an attempt to find something that is emotionally inspiring, the music side of it, of whatever I'm writing. So if it's a happy scene, if it's a sad scene, etc., I have that music going on. I listen to a lot of post-rock. I listen to Lowercase Noises, We Lost the Sea. I listen to things that are instrumental but have emotional quality to them. But then I'm working on a novel right now, and part of it's set in 1984. So I'll find on YouTube TV programming from 1984 that has commercials and has just the content from 84. And I'll leave that on. And my non-scientific theory is that somehow it's helping me tap into what my character's reality is, because this is something that they would be getting and processing. So I'm able to listen to, like, I'll have the post-rock going and the 1984 programming going at the same time.
And you can write if you... So when I listened to music, when I did listen to music, I could never listen to anything with comprehensible lyrics. Sometimes I would listen to like crazy metal where you can't understand anything at all, and it just kind of becomes a wash of energy.
Yeah.
Or I would listen to post-rock or jazz. But if I could discern any lyrics, then that would just short circuit my own word making circuitry.
Yeah. At the height of my being able to listen to other things, I could actually listen to Kerouac reading from On the Road and still write at the same time, because I was picking up on the energy, even though the words were there and I would be hearing the words, I would be able to just pick up on the energy of it. And so much of my writing, because I'm emotionally stunted and still fascinated with things like travel and driving across America, so much of that populates everything I write, from short stories to novels. There's always going to be at least one road trip that's probably going to stretch across America in everything that I write. There are always people in the car driving away from somewhere with the promise of a better life somewhere else. And there was a time period where I listened to Kerouac reading on the road frequently, and it would make perfect background noises, because it was so musical in its presentation and in his reading of it. Just even the speech patterns became drums and trumpets and saxophones. It all had this energy to it. And to me, it represented the great American adventure of the mid 20th century, when all of these things were possible and new, and people were discovering things like jazz and having their mind blown and being everywhere all at once. And the interstate system and the way that it condensed America, the way that it made it possible to go somewhere that you'd only heard about, the way that you could drive there on your own and show up in. Like, I remember I was listening to it and he mentions Three Forks, Montana, and I had just actually pulled into Three Forks, Montana around that time. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, this is something that would not have been accessible to my great grandparents, to say like, oh yeah, well, we'll see you in Three Forks, Montana. And be, okay, cool. We're going to load up a covered wagon and we'll see you in 6 months. And I'm like, no, I just took some trucker speed and drove 36 hours straight. Now here I am in Three Forks, Montana.
I do like a good audiobook. I like listening. I like, you mentioned the music and the cadence. If you get someone who's really good, at it. There was the New Yorker has a podcast of writers reading other writers' short stories. And I've got a few of those saved forever and ever on my phone.
Let's put a link to that in the show notes of this episode so that people can check that out. I guess I'm saying that because I would like to check that out.
John Updike's short story Playing with Dynamite on from that podcast is one of my favorite things. It's amazing.
What an amazing title.
Yeah. It's all about middle age. It's all about middle age readjustments. A Donald Barthelme story too, from that same podcast series. It was just those two I have saved on my phone and will listen to infinity times.
I listened to Dennis Johnson and John Steinbeck. I have audiobooks that I can listen to East of Eden a million times. Mm-hmm. I'm never not amazed at the ambition and the willingness to go for it. And Dennis Johnson, for my money, there are just sentences where I just think to myself, that is the coolest combination of words I've ever come across in the English language. And it just knocks me on my, it just knocks me over every time.
All right. I want the link to that.
Yeah. Another question that we got here is about platform. And I think that this is a good question for us to address. And I think it's good to also, again, review this between two different lenses, self-published and traditional publishing. But if someone comes to you and says and asks you if they need a platform, what is your response?
Again, it depends on genre. If you're writing prescriptive nonfiction, which would be kind of a how-to book, or billing yourself as the expert on something and you're going to write a book to share your expertise with the world, then that is really a non-starter unless you have a significant platform. You've got to have a built-in readership who already recognizes you as the expert and is waiting for this book. And significant, meaning like five figures in terms of combined followers. That's another question I get sometimes. Just like, what is a significant platform? And of course, the more people who know about you and your work, the better. But the five-figure 10,000 is a number that I've heard thrown around. If it's fiction, then what really matters is the quality of the manuscript, wouldn't you say?
I would. I also just want to go back about the, you know, followers and how do we judge platform. And you're completely right when you talk about how important it is to be recognized as an established expert in the field. When it comes to things specifically with social media and follower count, to me, it has been my experience that if there is mathematical formula there, nobody has cracked it as far as what the magic count is. And I know that because I have access to BookScan and I can see what sales are, I have seen authors who have follower counts near 100,000, over 100,000. And when they have a new book come out, there's not a super huge spike in sales. Even if it's just the author saying, hey, I've got a new book coming out, etc. So it's intuitively, it makes sense that a mark of being a recognized expert is that you have people who are following you on social media and are interested in what you're saying. What the sales connection is, I'm not sure. And there was an article, I think it was in the New Yorker a couple months ago, about the topic.
The Russian bots don't buy books.
And there's that, yeah. As far as with fiction, and again, right now I'm just going to answer from the lens of traditional publishing. I'm actually pretty radical in my saying that things like social media don't matter to people who are fiction writers, and that it's not something to be concerned about. What ends up happening is that people feel the need to have a social media presence. So they jump on, and then like in one weekend, they're super, super all about being on social media. And they're like, I'm going to tweet every day for a year, and I'm going to do all of these things. And then the enthusiasm runs out after a couple of hours or a couple of days. And also, if you're just now discovering these things, it's probably just not part of your personality, which is okay. Some people don't want to be excessively online and being a part of multiple conversations. But if you are going to be online, then I think you need to act like you would in the real world, and you can't just barge into conversations and start yelling about your new book that's come out, because if people don't know who you are, they're not really interested in hearing about it, and they don't want you screaming at them. I really do tell people not to get too caught up in what their social media footprint is if they're publishing novels. Also, it's important to point out, and this is again a distinction between traditional and self-publishing. Traditional, when it's operating at its best, is that so much of what goes into creating a book's momentum happens well underneath the surface and well in advance of release date. You've got publishing companies that are producing review copies of books that they're sending out 3 to 4 months in advance to all of the media that require that kind of lead time. And that's the New York Times, that's Publishers Weekly, that's Library Journal. You've got sales teams that are going to bookstores to talk to the buyers at bookstores about the books that the publishing company is excited about. And those sales teams presumably have identified based on things like where the author lives, where the book is set. And so you get this genuine, organic excitement about books well in advance of a reader ever really knowing that the book exists or that it's available for purchase, because it's not. So these are the things that kind of get into the publishing company's head, the bookselling community, the librarian community, in addition of going into individual stores. Sales reps are going to regional conferences, they're going to international conferences, like, well, formerly what was Book Expo America, to talk and to be a part of the conversation and to hopefully be part of the zeitgeist of what's coming out and what's important. And an author, an individual author on social media telling people that they have a book coming out and here's the pre-order link and here you go, that fades into the background noise real fast. It's much more important that booksellers, when a customer walks into their store, they're able to say, I have a perfect book for you. And that recommendation from a bookseller to a reader, a customer that comes into their store, is going to move a lot more than an author just pushing on social media. And that's one of the things that just never really gets taken into account when people talk about differences between traditional publishing and self-publishing. The idea is like, well, I can get my own editor. I can get my own cover designer. I can make sure that my book is at the quality it needs to be if I self-publish, which is true. And that's good. But distribution, sales, getting the word out, media, those things are much more difficult. And if you don't have the existing relationships, they're impossible. Now, someone's going to tell me like, well, no, this self-published book got reviewed in the New York Times last weekend. And fine. But I know that that's a rare event. It's nothing you can plan on. And I know that even for me, when I was running publishing companies, the first New York Times review that we got as a publishing company probably was a decade after we had started publishing books and sending books, every single book to the New York Times. You know, here, review this one, review this one, review this one. The sheer volume of books that they get, and then the fact that so many book review sections of major daily newspapers are gone, it's a near impossible feat. And the same thing holds true with Publishers Weekly, Library Journal. You send all of these things, and then you do it because you know you're supposed to. And you also know that the right review in the right place adds legitimacy and the ability to get the word out to the real people that you're trying to reach, readers that you don't know that are outside of your circle. That's the platform answer.
It's an interesting point about all of the distribution and sales work, because I'll hear sometimes when people are debating between traditional and self-publishing, they'll think about the creative control and they'll say, well, I want to do this my way. I don't want someone telling me how to do this. And that's true. That's a concern. And you certainly get a whole lot more creative control when you self-publish. But yeah, there are a lot of things happening behind the scenes that you end up paying a lot for, you know, in terms of the difference in royalties, the difference how you make per copy. But you can't replicate those things. You can't replicate that kind of publicity and distribution and sales effort, unless you're, you know, a very exceptional person with networks and sales networks and marketing savvy. But that's also why traditional publishing is so, so competitive. I think for memoir, we didn't talk about memoir within the platform conversation, but I think that memoir sits somewhere in between prescriptive nonfiction and novels. I feel like there are two types of memoirs. There are the types that are written beautifully like novels and therefore require less of a platform. And then there are, you know, what we sometimes call the train wreck memoir. These are, you know, the celebrity or the something, you know, I was addicted to 50 different drugs and almost died 17 times type memoirs, which often come from people who have gotten publicity for whatever the things that they've been through. But I think that for memoir platform, it's somewhere in between the massive established platform that you need as a prescriptive nonfiction author. And I don't think you are that radical. Your views on the importance of social media when it comes to fiction are, I've seen that in my experience through, you know, my window on the industry. It's the platform building is just work on writing the best book you can. That's the best thing you can do if you're a fiction writer.
Yeah, I would say in the earlier part of this century, when I would be at writing conferences, somebody somewhere snuck the word platform in. And then what happened is everybody started talking about platform and everybody was defining it differently. And it became a word that was often used and at the same time, not really all that clear what it meant. And because it's an industry where people want to make sure that they look like they're on the cutting edge and they understand things, I would be on a panel at a writing conference and an agent or another publisher would talk about how important it is to be on social media. And I'd be like, yeah, but you're the same people who were saying how important it was to have a book trailer 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, book trailers never sold a book. That's just, they didn't. There was this compulsive need for people to say what they thought they were supposed to say because they didn't want to look like they weren't hip or current and how to use MySpace or Facebook or, you know, whatever the evolution of it was. And I would call them out on those panels. I'd say, okay, cool. So you can show me the math about how all of this works and about follower count and book sales. And nobody could. And I just felt like someone has to stand up and say, this doesn't work. The two best-selling authors who I have published, neither one of them are active on social media. One of them is somebody who has been publishing books for a long time, developed a name through the support of large publishing. And so there's already a fan base that's just kind of waiting for the books when they come out every year like clockwork. The other one was a debut novel. The author won a prestigious award that also created a lot of book sales. And back to what your point was, Jason, if you write the best book that you can, and it really resonates with people, that's no guarantee that you're going to sell a lot of books. And at the same time, it's the way to really, if you write something that really moves people, it will become a part of the conversation. Getting it in front of them so that they know that it exists, that's the challenge. But to me, it's just so important to write the best book that you can. I feel like we could probably keep answering questions, but maybe we should leave some of these for another Q&A down the road. I wanted to remind people again that there are a variety of groups on our website that tackle a bunch of these things. Some of them are writing, some of them are talking more about individual author experiences in the publishing industry and things to look out for, things to do there. I also wanted to point out that the first query letter reviews that we are doing are now live on YouTube, and that we acknowledge that writing query letters is a mysterious process that has got a whole bunch of information about it online, some of which is contradictory. So we're going through individual query letters, talking about what works, what doesn't work. There will be an opportunity for people to submit their own query letters for inclusion in this program, where we will record our responses. As just a heads up, we will be doing that also at times to help raise money for certain causes. So we may identify a particular charity or nonprofit that is doing work. And if you donate directly to them, it will get your query letter read on air and responded to quicker. So just keep an eye out for that. And we will have that on our social media and on our website. Do you have anything else that you would like to say to the people?
I think we can wrap it there. Be well, write the best book you can. I think that's the moral of the story, is there's a lot of noise out there. Just write the best book you can.
And avail yourself to whatever means that you need to write the best book that you can. And each writer's journey is going to be different. If you enjoy this podcast, please remember to subscribe and review wherever you get your podcast. And if you're so inclined, we do have social media on the Twitter and the Instagram and the LinkedIn. Go ahead and give us a follow over there to make sure that you get the most current information.
For story.
For community. Collaborators.